And we're back, ladies and gentlemen, on the Vinnie Eastwood Show. Yep, civilization basically just got wiped out long ago, according to 187 cultures. What do you reckon?
See, Joe, why are you so sensitive to it? It doesn't matter how they got here anyway. There's various views. The question is, the thing is that the Komatua, in a time when they didn't have this sort of money grubbing going on and they could afford to be honest about their history, it's there in their histories. You know, even Ranganui Walker in his Struggle Without End book said that when the people got here, they were met by these other people and they fought them.
They called them the surveyors, I think, because they were all on the top of the hills and stuff all the time.
Right through. Martin Dutre is such a racist that he went and lived with a whole lot of Maori people for quite some years when he was younger.
Sounds like a bad guy to me.
Racists don't do that. I don't think Hitler was living in a kibbutz, you know.
he wasn't going to synagogue, was he?
Not a racist. He is a genuine seeker after the truth. You're trying to smear him, and I detest that. You're thrashing around trying to come up with all sorts of nonsense. But, you know, the fact is there was this stone city in the Waipoua Forest. It sounds fantastic. This tribe is covering it up. There were all these bones, which the honest Maori back in those days said, they're not ours, these larger-than-life people. Tasman saw these giants. We have Maori with red hair. Where did that come from? Mm. These are the sort of things you've got to look at. The people, the evidence that's here, and not grasp for straws on how they might or might not have got here. They evidently did get here, or at least that should be able to be discussed without iwi closing down the discussion. Now, here's another chart. I think if you can see this.
Bring it up all the way.
Evidence.
Oh, no, back and up. Sorry, John. way back.
I can't see you, see? So I'm
pull it back towards you, mate. Keep going.
But this is evidence.
And
that
stop.
This is evidence that evidence of these pre-Maori excavations were embargoed until
2063.
Why would you do that if you had nothing to hide? Why would the state do that if it wasn't trying to cover it up? Why are there hundreds of sites around the country where this sort of stuff's been going on? I'm less interested in the facts of the matter. I don't understand the facts about the pre-Maori so much. But I'm interested in why the state and why the iwi want to cover it up so much.
It's funny you should mention that because just recently, John, I've been interviewing some guys who are researching into ancient American history. And it turns out, you know Wrigley's chewing gum, the Wrigley's family, not too long ago, I think back in the 1970s, they had a museum in Massachusetts where they had giant bones. And they were on display in all the cases and everything, and you could even purchase some at the gift shop from real giants.
You know, these questions have to be answered. They do sound fantastic. But we should have the debate. Joe should be debating with Martin on this one. Let Martin have a say for 2 hours, because he could talk for the whole time and it would be mind-boggling. The crew from Maori TV were tremendously impressed with what Martin was telling them. The journalist couldn't wait to cover it up, but she was pretty mind-boggled as well. Martin just kept making sense. That's the point. He keeps making sense. It's very hard to defeat him if you're not into the archaeology area. So we need to get an archaeologist to go up against him. Get the state's best archaeologist. He would be confident of explaining his position. Only when you get that would Joe probably be anywhere near convinced. He'd probably find some other way to denigrate Martin. But Martin would be very happy to go up against whoever the state says is their foremost archaeologist with the facts, as long as the other guy is going to respond with facts as well.
Mm. And I feel also we're both ganging up on Joe at this point. I'd like to allow you to respond, Joe, if you can.
Well, I can explain who Patapārihi are. They are... Patapārihi are mystical creatures similar to leprechauns in Ireland. They're pale-skinned and they're about 30 centimetres tall, the size of a smurf. What Dutry's done, is why Māori gets so insulted by this, is he's hijacked our history or a fairy tale we have, and he's trying to use it to undermine treaty settlements, and is the sole purpose. If he can prove that Māori were here in New Zealand and colonised New Zealand after British Celtics, then some theory that he has is that this would undermine the treaty settlements, and because Māori were the interlopers.
No, he doesn't say that at all. It doesn't affect the treaty. Well, he might. I don't think he does.
I think his argument with the treaty is just the Littlewood Treaty. The ancient thing is just an archaeological interest to him.
Yeah, whoever might have been here before Māori, and it's the Kamatawa that told him. Not, you know, you've got to argue with them that who the Patapārāhei were, and he's got these evidence of people with red hair and so on and white skin. It's physical evidence, but. You know, it doesn't alter the fact that Māori were certainly the incumbents in 1840. Nobody's questioning that. It doesn't affect the treaty process whatsoever. It certainly affects the claim to indigeneity, but that is extinguished by Māori's own admission, quite proudly, that they are indigenous to the other side of the Pacific. You know, so I don't think the pre-Māori changes all that much. It makes things pretty interesting. And it certainly undermines the claim that, you know, we were here first. I don't think being here first has any bearing on anything anyway. I don't think that I'm more of a New Zealander because my first relatives came here in 1842 than my wife, who was an immigrant in 1993. Any more than your Māori forebears might have come here in 1350. I think it's irrelevant what time we got here in a democracy where all people are supposed to be equal.
Hmm. Now, may I ask, Joe, what's more likely to you, that there was perhaps an ancient civilization that was passed, that maybe through oral tradition is now passed down and there's evidence for now, or that there's an oral tradition and evidence for blue Smurfs, as you say?
That was
something that I found very interesting, because what happens through oral traditions is that things that used to be real become sort of, romanticized or fantasized or something like that, and the truth gets lost over time. I would say that that's probably a bit more likely than there actually being fairies that we just can't find now, but that's me. Joe?
Yeah, I think what Martin Dutre's done is he's just taken a fairy tale and he's ran away with it. It's like me saying that that Māori managed to, at the time of Christ, managed to colonise England, and King Arthur was actually Māori, and also saying that what's that wizard that they used to have back then?
The Wizard of Oz? No.
Merlin. Well, that's like me saying that Merlin was a great Māori tohunga and he actually came from the South Pacific and they had travelled all the way to England. And it's really offensive to British history. And if I started up an organisation that said that, Paul Moon, all of the national historians would call me out on it. They'd have issues with that type of history.
Right. It's a good line, but, you know, what you've got that's highly inconvenient is that your elders say the same stuff as Martin. They told Martin this stuff. Now, until you deal with that one, you haven't got a coherent argument. Why does Māori history, why does David Rankin, who's a chief up in the north there, say that Te Tai Tokerau means on the tide from the Tokelau's, we just kind of drifted here, which must be even more offensive to you. And I'm not saying he's right. I'm just saying that he seems to think he is. So you've got strains, all sorts of strains of opinion here, there, and everywhere that we can adopt to suit our agenda if we want to.
Hmm.
Why bag a man who, you know, you're prepared to accept that James Bellich and Claudia Orange couldn't possibly spend their entire lives, you know, perpetuating a left-wing myth. But you are prepared to accept that Martin Dutre can spend a greater part of his life coming up with far-fetched accounts, which he seems to be able to talk about at great length, but nobody seems to want to hear it.
Hmm.
You're being selective.
Well, that might be because historians, professional historians and archaeologists, they use modern science when they investigate these things. Like, they use DNA testing. Yes. They also use carbon dating.
Yes.
So Martin Dutre, I don't see that he's done any DNA testing on...
Well, you've been paying attention, because there was a carbon dating done that dated something to do with a garden up in the Waipora city at something like 1700 BC. But, of course, that was shut down. Why are these things being shut down? You haven't responded to why these things, if they're so innocuous, are being locked away until everybody's dead. 2063. Why would you do that if it's all just nonsense?
Where was that document from, John, exactly?
Well, that was the work. I've got the original one here somewhere, but I probably won't find it in time. But it was a request for the carbon dating evidence that somebody overheard one of the archaeologists from the Crown mentioning, and that's the response that came back. There was a senior archaeologist who discovered this stuff, but they were all shut down. After the state discovered stuff they didn't really want to discover of this so-called stone city with all sorts of stone houses and walls and things like that that weren't particularly Maori in origin.
Yeah. There's hundreds of thousands of sites around the world that that point to an advanced civilization that was incredible at working with stones that had a global trade routes and things like that. All of it. The exact same thing happened, John. The exact same thing. All the testing's blocked, all the people get demonized, and it gets rejected out of the media, they get called names and all of that kind of stuff. And none of the people that are attacking them or arguing against them have ever even read it into their research. And if they have, they deny its existence in the first frickin' place.
I mean, it's utterly fascinating to everybody, but why aren't there documentaries about it with people on both sides going hammer and tongs? So that we at home can sort of figure out who's telling the truth or who isn't. But those documentaries aren't allowed to be made. Now, thanks to Māori TV, Martin and us bringing along a second camera, Martin is making a documentary about his tour on that day that wasn't shown, and the things that he said and footage that he has from other times. So they've been very helpful in making that happen. But why isn't it on the History Channel? Why isn't, they broadcast evidence for much less.
Mm. Well, I've put it on YouTube for Martin, and Martin's written a book and all of that. You've seen the thing on YouTube. You've read the book, haven't you, Joe?
What book's that?
I'll take that as a no.
It was called Celtic New Zealand, wasn't it? I haven't read it either, but I just know this guy. He's a mild-mannered guy. He's not a racist. He's a very thorough researcher, and he's able and willing to debate anybody, anytime, anywhere about anything. Mm. That, to me, suggests a pretty good either completely deluded sort of sociopath or something, or he's what he claims he is. I think he's what he claims he is, and I just wish, and I notice that nobody will debate him. Mm. And I notice the same thing on climate change, and that's what makes me...
Same thing on climate change, same thing on 9/11.
Why not stage the debate,
I mean, today, here, for example, here we are, gentlemen, we're having a genuine debate about a real issue that actually affects this country, and both sides are allowed to speak. Why is that not happening with all of these major issues in our country? I'll tell you why, because whoever's in control doesn't want them to. Now, it might be like a feeding frenzy where every shark has its own agenda, but they all have the same target.
I think it's called a democracy, and I thank you for the opportunity to have this debate. And I think, Joe, we agreed at halftime that we're both getting a fair shake. That's what you want in a democracy. If I stuff up, if I tell porkies and Joe can prove it, then that's bad for me, but I've had my chance. And that's all we want. We want a chance to put our view in the public to see both sides, and that should happen on everything.
Mm. Do you believe that to be true, Joe, even if you don't agree with what people's opinions are, that they should be able to at least say their piece?
Most certainly. I'd like to get write a response to some of the comments that John's made. The only history I've read of New Zealand is the Penguin History of New Zealand by Michael King. And that's quite a credible source of history, and it says despite a plethora of conspiracy theories of Phoenicians and a whole lot of other civilizations, he makes it very clear the first civilization or the first people to make the shores of New Zealand are Polynesians. There's no one else. There's no
sure
no other civilization. But also, I was John mentioned David Rankin as some Kaumatua. Well, he's not. David Rankin's actually no one within Ngāpuhi. He's holds no ranking, despite the what he says is otherwise. But with the whole alternate history that Martin Dutre has portrayed. The New Zealand archaeology...
How much do you know about what he said, though? I mean, again, you haven't seen his presentation on YouTube or read his book, so you don't know what alternative history he's talking about, do you, Joe?
I have seen his YouTube clip. But
how long was it? Was it the hour and a half one where he does the full slide presentation?
No, it's got some funny music to it. But what I'm getting at is the New Zealand Archaeological Society have denied these alternate histories emphatically. They've said that all these entire histories are based on racism and nothing more.
And we will be right back after the break, ladies and gentlemen, at thevinnieeastwoodshow.com. It's the lighter side of genocide, because if you lose your sense of humour about things, you will go friggin' nuts. Back in a tick. And gentlemen, now John, I believe right of reply is yours. Joe was saying that absolutely all of the history being put across by Martin Dutre and others around the country is based on racism and absolutely nothing more. Care to respond to that?
Yeah, bureaucrats tend to do that, and societies tend to do that sort of thing. Do you accept Michael's view on the massacre of the Moriori in the Chatham Islands, because he's wrote a book about that as well? I'd like to put up this slide here, which talks about the real Waitangi we should be thinking about, the one in the Chatham Islands where women were staked to the beach and then slaughtered and eaten and so on. I mean, this is the sort of stuff that, unfortunately, you have to accept Michael King also talked about. But he, you know, you're saying that because Michael King wrote the definitive history of New Zealand as perceived by the establishment, that we must believe him and him only. And Paul Moon, when it suits you, you believe Paul Moon. You don't believe him when he writes this horrid practice about the cannibalism, but you believe him when he says things that you do agree to. I'm saying that all history is contestable. None of us were there. We don't know what really happened. That's the nature of history. We can only accept the assumptions of people who've studied, and Martin has studied it, as well as Michael King. You know, he's just as intelligent as Michael King and those other guys, and he deserves to put his evidence and be allowed to have his evidence considered. Michael King may never have seen it. He certainly took a lot of trouble to go over to the Chatham Islands and see the evidence there, and he wrote about that. You know, I'm just saying, give a guy a fair go. Don't demonise him because you don't agree with his agenda or his findings. Give the guy a go. Put him on this program, Vinny, up against Joe, or if there's a better person than Joe that can argue the toss about archaeology, give him his go. I reckon he'd lap it up. Then we'd see what we make of Martin Dutre, you know, in a fair debate.
Now, on top of this, there's the other element here is, in my opinion, the establishment in anything tends to be wrong most of the times about things, but you only find out that they're wrong in the fullness of time. For example, do you believe that JFK was the result of a conspiracy or a lone gunman?
I think he was the result of a sexual act between his parents, but that's just my view.
But in the fullness of time, so much things have come out, like the Zapruder film, etc., that have disproven and shown that every element of the official story has been debunked and is simply not true. However, what is the truth doesn't get accepted and brought into the mainstream consciousness, even though approximately 90% of Americans don't believe the establishment official account.
It's certainly true that we enjoy these things. You know, we kind of want to believe that it was a CIA plot or there was another gunman. And we kind of enjoy the idea that the British, that the American government might have brought down the World Trade Center. It's attractive, you know.
I don't know about you, but the thought that that there's a criminal, I'm not sure, John. I think that the fact that there might be a criminal element in charge of the United States that would kill its own president, much less 3,000 of its own citizens, is not a comforting thought to me, nor anybody who truly studies it.
Choice of word, attractive. It's not. It's attractive from the...
Intriguing, I think, is the word.
On this, yeah, from the sort of water cooler discussion point of view, we all like to have views on stuff, and we all like to, you know, believe that far-fetched things are going on. And we've got to discount all that. You know, I used to believe in, you know, at school, I read the books of James Bruce Cathy about the, you know, Harmonic 695, Harmonic 30, all very, very attractive, you know, evidence for UFOs and so on. I'm still not saying it's wrong. I don't know. But it was kind of nice. It was fun to want to believe it anyway. But you've got to discount all that if you're honest, and you've got to give both sides a fair go, and you've got to behave as though you're some sort of jury in a court of law. And I find that increasingly, or maybe it's just that I'm getting more interested, but I see things like the climate debate, and you see vested interests in both sides putting up very plausible cases. And God knows where the truth is. You just but it's the same with this, you know, this treaty debate. You know, we're both, I think, honest, honestly trying to find the truth of these matters. I'm saying that Joe and co have a vested interest that I don't have. Do I really, you know, am I really trying to create a legacy for myself as a racist? Is that really where I get my jollies? I tell you, I'm not. I don't. Why would you? Maybe I'm just trying to speak up for people that aren't being heard, who just happen to be the majority, the hoodwinked majority. Maybe Joe and co are doing it for the money.
How do you respond to that? Oh, actually, before you do, I have another idea, because there are vested interests, and when in politics, who I vote for is either the person who gets most left out of the media or most demonised by the media. In New Zealand, that tends to be Hone Hariwera and New Zealand First Leader Winston Peters. But anyway, Joe, I'm sorry, go ahead.
Well, John showed that... that little chart of his about the Chatham Islands and Moriori, I actually do accept the history of Michael King, because he's a professional historian. I've got no other reason to.
So is James Cameron.
But where it comes unstuck for you, John, and also Martin Dutre, is yous are talking about... the mainstream of New Zealand perceive as a conspiracy theory. But you also, on the other hand, you're trying to convince the public of New Zealand that Alan Titford's innocent. Now, you either drop these conspiracy theories, or how are people supposed to believe you that Alan Titford's been framed?
What, do you want me to tell you? I mean, I provided evidence. I don't actually have it here, but I gave it to the girl from Māori TV. And she wouldn't put it on. An affidavit that a friend of Susan Titford's, Alan's sister-in-law, who didn't get on with Alan, said that she heard Sue say that her father confessed on his deathbed to burning down the house that she subsequently went and said that Alan burnt down. That's evidence. That's not proof. But that's evidence. That's as good evidence as there was in the whole of the rest of the trial, where basically her word was accepted for the things that Alan was supposed to have done, 39 things. He's been locked up for 24 years. No one believes that's fair. 24 years for a crimes in which no one died, that is a state fit-up. At least the sentence is. Where else do you get a minister of the crown, John Carter, working with a wife in a property in a marital separation case? Why would he do that, do you think? The rapes, I could go on. One of the rapes, she said, happened on or about the 7th of July 2009. She told the police that in her own diary. She didn't say that. She said, oh, Alan wanted sex. I said, no, he pushed me out of bed. Now, that's not very nice. It's the opposite of rape, however. So I'm putting up evidence, Joe, one after the other. I could go on, and you'll probably say that it doesn't account for anything. There's no reason why you could possibly find him innocent. I'm saying there's every reason why you could find him innocent. First of all, the state has a real reason to lock this bugger up because he proved that the treaty claim on his farm that cost him his farm was a fraud. I can go into detail on that, and I've done it on my blog tonight in the complaint by Mike Baker to the Broadcasting Standards Authority, a whole list of questions that should be put to those people who were just blindly believed, like Paul Moon, like Alex Nathan, like who was the other one? I think Ranganui Walker. Just blindly believed. We're putting up evidence all the time. Martin Dutre does nothing but put up evidence. I put up evidence and you just laugh at it, you know. Well, I laugh at you for laughing at it because you should be coming up with corresponding evidence. I'm saying a man was put away for 24 years for crimes he most likely didn't commit. There's certainly evidence he didn't commit the bigger ones. And you're just sort of laughing it off, I suppose.
So, well, hold on. Did he actually? What's the current penalty for murder in New Zealand? It's like life in prison, isn't it?
Look,
with good behaviour, 25 years.
Murderers have got less than that. Graham Burton, one of the worst murderers, got 26 years. You know, Titford did nothing on that scale and got 24. Ask yourself. And they started. And the judge started his. He started his sentencing at 36, can you believe? You know, William Bell got 33. It is just so obviously corruption on behalf of that judge and all the people surrounding the case. The police, people who bashed Titford up because he complained that the Māori were molesting him. That's why the father-in-law burnt the house down, incidentally, because he, it was the only way he could think of to get his daughter away from the threats and harassment and violence from Te Roro. That's why I wasn't going to, you know, apologise to them when Mihi Nairangi Forbes seemed to think that the highest priority was to apologise to Te Roro, not to Alan Titford. You know, it's just one of the policemen actually apologised, most heartfelt apology to Titford for the harassment that he delivered upon him and others. But Titford said, will you repeat it in public? The guy said, no, it'll affect my new career. So Titford said, well, I don't accept your apology then. Why should I? But, you know, there's so much scandal going on in the last 20 or 30 years over him. His wife still believes that the research they did was accurate. So it doesn't affect the fact that he's been demonised, you know, like you guys try to demonise Martin Dutre and me. And well, Titford was the arch enemy, so he was thoroughly demonised. But even if he did all those things as charged, as sentenced, doesn't alter a jot the work he did on the Te Roro claim and the fact that that was all shonky. There's no logic that connects the two. And his wife and he both agreed on that, which is remarkable considering she is out to get him in every other way. You know, she admits that the Māori shot the stock and did certain other things, but she claims, you know, when it suits her, that Alan burnt the house down, even though her father now did. But, you know, so that's something I want to get out, is that there's no connection between the two, but somehow the media have bought the idea that because he's this violent person in other parts of his life, that he must therefore be dishonest, which has nothing to do with violence, regarding the work, that, the forensic work that he did on the claim. It doesn't connect.
Can I get a write a response on this, Vinny?
We're waiting. Go for your life, man.
Okay. Alan Titford is guilty as charged. Titford knew for 20 years that the people of Te Rāroa had not committed any crime. They hadn't burnt down his house, but he was silent. He didn't let anyone know. He didn't approach the police force. He just kept quiet about it. And what Alan Titford is, could you let me finish, John. What Alan Titford is a set of coincidences. First off, his boat mysteriously sinks. He gets insurance money for that. And then he goes in from that insurance money and he buys a farm. And then what happens is his house mysteriously burns down and the Treaty of and the Waitangi Tribunal end up giving him $3 million. Now, that's a set of three coincidences that I just don't really buy. And then, now that he's sitting in prison, he's blaming it all on a dead patsy that's and is passing the blame on to the father-in-law. What Alan Titford is guilty of is he made Māori and Te Rārua look like this avaricious group who are just very greedy, when it wasn't the truth. He turned Northland into Mississippi burning. He created so much racial tension that Māori hated Pākehā and Pākehā hated Māori. And if John honestly believes that Alan's getting a fair deal, well, I can bring up some examples of some Māori activists. There's Benjamin Petty Nathan, who damaged the America's Cup, and he got 2 years imprisonment. Annette Sykes was actually his lawyer, and all he did was attack a bit of steel. Now, Titford's been out raping people, committed perjury, committed arson, and he gets 24 years. Of course he should get 24 years. Also, Mike Smith just went up to One Tree Hill and chopped down a tree. No one was hurt. They're just destroying sentimental things. And Mike Smith ended up getting 6 months periodic detention. So if John thinks that Alan's getting off lightly, well, what about activists who are Māori? They don't get off lightly.
I don't think you're listening to anything. I mean, getting off lightly? I think Alan's getting off lightly, you're saying? 24
no.
years? That's what you said just then. But look, where do I start? Sunk the boat. Well, the boat was made of steel. There was petrol tanks there. You can't take an axe to a steel boat, as Sue Titford maintains. You said that the Waitangi Tribunal gave him $3 million. When? He bought his farm for $600,000. When he was forced to sell it, he got $200,000. The Māori TV program, quite mischievously, if that's probably the least of it, said that he made five times as much as he paid for it. Well, first of all, there was quite a lot of inflation at that time between those two dates, but he had to pay back mortgages that he couldn't afford to pay because the tribe occupied the land. He couldn't develop his beachfront property. That was the whole reason why he bought the farm, so that he could make a profit developing the beachfront property and so he could pay his mortgage back. There were other costs as well. He had to that included his stock, $700,000. You know, just complete misinformation from start to finish, Joe. I don't know. Well, I just don't know. When I hear stuff like that, I just think that people are there is a lower threshold of honesty going on here. It seems to be endemic in Māoridom. Treachery seems to be tolerated from the days when Maui double-crossed his mother, and it's still going on. Treachery in battle and treachery in debate. You know, we've got to have some sort of basis of truth before we can have a meaningful debate. And you're not coming from truth. You're coming from propaganda and indoctrination. And once again, I'm putting up facts and you're spouting stuff that you've heard somewhere from someone biased. But, you know, if you look at that case forensically, he proved that claim was wrong and he has been vilified for it. And that is the most ghastly thing that has happened in New Zealand for some time, and you're excusing it. You're saying that he deserved 24 years. Even if he had done those three rapes and the arson, which you're very happy to accept that the father-in-law had done because it exonerates Te Rōra. Alan quite logically suspected Te Rōra, they were doing so many other things to him, but even he came to the conclusion later on that it probably wasn't them. He couldn't understand what was in it for them doing that, so he had expressed that. He was prepared to change his mind, and rightly so. The first he heard of his father-in-law burning down the house was about the same time I heard it, when the affidavit came in. It wasn't from, as Mihir Nairani Forbes said, one of the Titford family. It was one of the Cochrane family. It was his in-laws who didn't get on with him. You know, so just complete misinformation.
Mm-hmm. Joe, do you have a response?
Well, I think the only person who we need to look at here for treachery is Alan Titford. He's very treacherous. One of the things that he made a vast mistake on was he knew that he would upset Te Rārua if he went and subdivided the land, because one of the things that he knew of about the land, it was an urupa or a cemetery. And what the local iwi were upset about is they just wanted to connect with their dead ancestors in this cemetery or urupa. So this would fly in the face of common sense when you know there's racial tension. Why would you go and subdivide land, upsetting the people even further?
Because to pay off a mortgage, is what he said.
Yeah, to pay the mortgage. Why would
If you bought some land, then subdivided it so you could pay off the mortgage so that you wouldn't have to keep working for the rest of your life until you were dead to pay it off, wouldn't you?
It's like Dover Samuels. I mean, he said, look, you know, the white man is an idiot. Once you put a cloak on him, he turns to jelly. He said, look, we can make a claim that there's bones of our ancestors. We're such a bloodthirsty lot. There's bones of our ancestors up and down every beach in New Zealand, so we can claim the lot. You know, just because you've got a few bones in there, you're supposed to have cared so deeply for their ancestors. Why do they slaughter them in such numbers and eat them, you know? But the point is, this is the 20th century then. He paid a fair price for his land. He's entitled to use his land. If there are some bones there, well, so what? Why does that give someone else the right to come into his land? You know, those guys were threatening to kill. I think, I better be a bit careful about who I name, but I think that Harawira was there. I think Shane Jones might have been in there on that protest. You just don't do, in a civilised society, you don't go and occupy someone else's land. You go through the legal channels to apply for it, but you don't go and occupy, you don't go sticking a bloody pole on someone else's land, you don't go shooting the stock. You seem to think, with your morals, that you can do that. And that's what disgusts so many New Zealanders, that Maori think they can walk onto someone else's land that's been paid for and do whatever they like and disrupt his living. Well, he is a very determined man, and he wasn't going to put up with that, and he's paid quite a high price.
Mm-hmm. Well, let's say that's true for a moment here, and then just ask, if the reverse happened today, if a bunch of Pākehā walked onto a marae that was recently built, for example, saying that there used to be some Pākehā cemetery that wasn't marked there or something like that, would they be able to come onto the land and confiscate it from Māori, occupy it, that kind of... No, there'd be huge uproar, but the reverse is not true. And I think the reason why there's like an 80% or whatever a support of John's kind of theories and findings and whatnot is because maybe there's a little bit of racism involved, perhaps. I know, John, we've spoken privately. You've told me that there's a lot of racists that support you and you don't support them and you don't like to read their emails and whatnot, and when they comment on your blog sites, you tell them to clean up their act.
So there's
one element there, but the other element is people who believe in things like law, private property rights.
You can't have it both ways. You can't sign a treaty that where you sign up to the laws of British Empire, for better or worse, and then you just take them into your own hands. I mean, that's just corrupt. And, you know, you've got to go through the process. And when it suits Māori, they're very happy with British law. When it doesn't, they're not. In 1941, again, for the second time, I think the first time was 1896, the law found that there was no case to answer over that the claim that there were two reserves, or they should have been provided in the sale of that land in 1876, I think it was. There was a pro-Maori judge who was an underling of the ultimate judge who thought that there was, but the ultimate judge, the chief judge, said there wasn't, so it was game over. But, of course, that never stops radical Maori these days. They open it up because they know they can get away with it, because they know they've got a kangaroo court called the Waitangi Tribunal that was set up deliberately to find in their favour, and guess what? It did. Well, that doesn't impress fair-minded people.
May I ask John or Joe, if you know the statistics on it, how many times has the Waitangi Tribunal not ruled in favour of the Māori claimant?
I'm not aware of.
Has it ever happened? Once?
I haven't studied the Waitangi Tribunal. But what did happen with the Alan Titford case is a law got passed through that private land was not to be used for treaty settlements. And because Alan Titford had been getting around burning down his own home, New Zealand law was influenced. So this was the 80% getting it wrong.
That's because the various prime ministers had promised, David Longy saying so in so many words, that there will not, you know how he used to talk, yes, there will not be one farmer losing his land to a treaty claim. And, of course, he either was lying or he certainly got it wrong, because they certainly, the Titfords certainly did lose their land to a treaty claim. And there was much more corruption involved than I've probably got time to outline, but they doctored the sale agreement. You know, Titford was prepared in the end, after his parents were threatened by the state with by the rural bank with taking their own farm, because it was collateral over the farm, which Titford couldn't afford to pay for anymore because the Maoris had occupied the thing and made it unviable. Nobody wanted to buy his sections. He reluctantly agreed in the end to accept a lower sum, but he changed the agreement. He said, I'm signing this, this, and this, but I'm not signing this, this, and this. Now, that was his opinion, and that's what he signed. And the Crown Law Office, who are extremely culpable in this, people like Scary Mary Ann Thompson, who was subsequently found guilty of that immigration fraud, people like her doctored that sale agreement to rub out Titford's amendments. Now, that is a very shonky piece of work, and that is what the state does not want to get out there, and that's why I'm putting it out there. Things like that. Facilitating Maori claims because it was worth votes, and frankly, because people were intimidated. Peter Tapsell said to Titford, look, it's not fair, but I can't control my people. They're violent. They're going to get you. You'd really better get off the land and go and live somewhere else, because it's not going to stop. And it's that intimidation that I'm sickened by when it comes to radical Maori, and that's why I'm standing up.
And also, incidentally, because of the intimidation of time slots, we are also going to have to take a break and stand up for that. We'll be right back, ladies and gentlemen.